Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Okay, you have found Forum, Nature Biotechnology's podcast, where we take papers recently published in our pages or elsewhere and discuss them with leading researchers in the field. My name is Brady Huggett, and this is episode 7. But for this episode, we've done something a little different. This is associated with our July focus issue on CRISPR tools and therapies, and we gathered a couple of leading voices in the field to have a conversation. We have Marcus Elsner, senior editor at Nature Biotechnology, speaking with David Liu, who's in the Department of Chemistry and Chemical Biology at Harvard, and he's also a co-founder of Editas Medicines, and Jennifer Doudna in the Molecular and Cell Biology and Chemistry departments at the University of California, Berkeley, and she's also a co-founder of Caribou Biosciences. And yeah, I think that's all you need to know, so let's just get right to it. Here's Marcus Elsner kicking it off.
Jennifer, David, thank you very much for being a guest on our podcast. So we're here to talk about CRISPR and genome editing and what the current stage of the field is and what the future might bring. And I think my first question is that, as hard as it seems to remember, there was a time before we had CRISPR when we had ZFNs, TALENs, meganucleases. And so what do you think we have learned from those days that is just still relevant? And are those tools, maybe especially for clinical applications, still relevant today? I think start with Jennifer.
Okay. Sure. Well, thank you, Marcus, for inviting us. It's great to be here with you and with David Liu. I would say that the field of genome editing has been around quite a while. I was a student in the 1980s when I remember, you know, people like Peter Durbin who were using oligonucleotides that had chemical modifications that allowed DNA cutting. And that was actually a technology that was used to map the Huntington gene originally. In Boston, you know, at Mass General Hospital, that was something done while I was there. And then since then, as you know, there've been a whole progression of really exciting technologies that you mentioned, using in particular engineered proteins to trigger targeted changes to genomes. And what that really did was, I think, you know, it showed the potential for that technology to be really, truly transformative, and gave a number of labs the ability to engineer genomes and ask important questions about the function of genes that couldn't really have been addressed prior to having the ability to manipulate DNA in a site-specific way in cells. And I think what CRISPR did was it came along at sort of an opportune moment when the field was primed for the excitement around genome editing, the potential of a technology that could trigger targeted changes, but it provides something that those earlier tools didn't, which is the ease of use and the programmability that just became so easy to manipulate that any lab essentially that had basic skills in molecular biology could adopt the CRISPR technology. And that's really what's happened over the last 8 years. I think it's been quite quite remarkable to see how this tool has really spread globally. It's enabled all sorts of incredible science, and we're now really on the verge of being able to see it applied, I hope, fairly broadly to treat genetic disease and do all sorts of other things. Maybe we'll get into that.
Mm-hmm. You want to add to that, David?
Yeah, sure. Marcus, thank you for having us. And I totally agree with and actually have a similar history, being inspired by some of the early work of some bioorganic chemists. When I was a prospective graduate student visiting Caltech, Peter Durbin actually showed me some exciting data using his polyamides to, as he called it, digitally address DNA. And that concept, I think he captured the important aspect of the concept of digitally addressing DNA. That is, recognizing that if you could specify a sequence to manipulate, that capability would be very powerful. And as Jennifer eloquently explained, generations of tools successively improved and diversified our ways of doing so. And that's brought us to this new era. And I think many people may not fully appreciate, unless they're in the field, that we are now in a new era of human genome editing, where human patients have been edited for the first time, meaning their DNA has been purposefully changed in their cells to treat diseases. And it's a remarkable accomplishment. And it's also a moment for us to make sure we're proceeding in a thoughtful way.
Do you think those older techniques still have a role to play? I mean, of course, there are companies like Sangamo, Selectus, that use TALENs, CFNs. How do you see the trade-offs between using different technologies, the pros and cons in 2020?
I definitely think that all of those methods and proteins, both engineered and taken from nature, have their own niche. And I say that not just because it sounds like a discrete way to evaluate and compare the different approaches people have taken, but really because they each have different properties. So zinc fingers, for example, are small. They tend to be less immunogenic. Tail proteins are larger, but unlike CRISPR, they don't rely on an RNA. And when RNA delivery is challenging, like into some subcellular organelles, RNA delivery is proven to be a challenge. Tails have actually proven to find a really important niche. For example, in the mitochondria, researchers have used TALENs to destroy targeted copies of mitochondrial DNA. And despite efforts from many labs to use CRISPR in mitochondria, those efforts have not really been fruitful yet because of the challenges of RNA delivery. So that's just one example, and I think there are many others that highlight the value and the unique strengths of each of those approaches.
Yeah, I guess I would just add that I think anytime you have technologies that are layered on each other and build off of what you learn from the use of individual types of tools, you're going to learn things that help make each of those technologies better, right? So I think that, you know, one of the interesting things that's come out of the comparisons of using TALENs, zinc finger nucleases, meganucleases, and CRISPR is that there's been a very deep appreciation for on versus off targeting and what determines that for these different technologies. And I think that, you know, there are, I think, very interesting examples where in some cases, one or the other of these tools turns out to be better for a particular application. So at some level, it's kind of nice to have, you know, a few tools in the toolbox. If you need to do something and one tool isn't ideal, as David said, you can pull another one out.
Mm-hmm. So with the current arsenal of CRISPR enzymes that we have, what would be your wish list? What capabilities do you think are missing that we still need to engineer into those enzymes?
Can I take a stab at that, David? because I know you have a lot to say.
No, go for it.
But I'll tell you my two big ones. My two big ones are one is ensuring that that precision is achieved in editing. So not just triggering a change at a targeted place in a genome, but triggering a desired change and ensuring that it happens the same way in every cell. And so, you know, one of the forefronts right now in the field is figuring out how to get homology-directed repair working well. That would be, a very transformative step to get, you know, have the ability to induce cells to integrate a desired sequence, you know, especially if it was possible to integrate very large DNA sequences where you could introduce entire genes or sets of genes into a targeted position in a genome, would be very powerful. So I think that's one area where there's lots of work still to be done. And the other really big one is delivery and ensuring that whatever tool you're using can be introduced efficiently into cells, and not just into cells growing in a laboratory dish, but into a patient, into a plant, into an existing organism where you want to achieve editing in a tissue. And you want to be able to do it in situ, and you want to be able to do it with very high efficiency, very low toxicity, and the kind of precision that will allow a disease-causing mutation to be corrected or a trait to be introduced with very high efficiency. So I think for me, those are the two big ones that are on the table.
I agree with everything Jennifer just said, and maybe I'll slightly expand on one of them and give a different twist on another, which is, I think, determining the relationship between cell states and cell types and genome editing outcomes is a great frontier for both genome editing people, biologists, doctors, agriculturalists, and so understanding that complicated relationship, which integrates chemistry, DNA repair, cell biology, and many other disciplines, is one really important frontier for the field. And the other I would say, which Jennifer already touched on, is we've seen some really exciting discoveries of Cas-associated, CRISPR-associated transposases that have the capability of inserting large pieces of DNA in a programmable manner. And I think we're all holding our breath to hope that those transposases can work in mammalian cells, because introducing putatively therapeutic genes into targeted positions in mammalian cells could be a really important advance for gene therapy. So I'm hopeful that the talented groups of Sam Sternberg, Fanjian, and others will have success in transitioning those technologies into mammalian cells.
How about recombinases? I remember that paper from the Buchholz group in Germany a while ago, where they designed recombinases to remove HIV proviruses from the human genome. Do you think this kind of approaches could yield recombinases that would be useful for other diseases to replace sequences without generating double-stranded breaks? Or even
this was a quest of ours for years. And we did actually publish one paper on CRISPR recombinase, CRISPR recombinase, but it has a number of caveats. I mean, I think as background, as your question implies, a recombinase that would be a hypothetical, fully programmable recombinase would be, in some respects, an ultimate genome editing agent, because recombinases can do straight up replacement of arbitrary segments of DNA for arbitrary other segments of DNA. Mm-hmm. The challenge is there, among many other challenges, but a key challenge is that there isn't a universal recombinase catalytic domain that has proven to be sort of modular and to not green its own sequence requirements. So we used one that the late Carlos Barbas engineered, called GinBeta, and we integrated it into Cas9, and we called this Rec Cas9, And it was programmable to some extent, but it still inherited the fairly strong sequence requirements of the gin beta catalytic units. And it also didn't have very high activity. While its activity was detectable in human cells, it was pretty weak. So it remains kind of an aspiration, and I hope the field actually aspires to finish the job.
Yeah, I guess there's no hope of finding something like that in nature.
Never know.
Well, you never know.
I never bet against nature.
Maybe staying with the tools that we have, one concern about genome editing that always comes up is the potential for off-targeting of the CRISPR enzymes. And over the years, there has been a lot of development of high-fidelity variants. Do you feel that problem with the variants that we have has largely been solved, or is there still some way to go?
Well, I could take a stab at that. I mean, I think that, as you said, there's been a lot of really nice engineering in the field to come up with variants of the Cas proteins that have intrinsically higher fidelity of DNA recognition and encoding, which has been great. I think one of the things that labs who have tried to adopt many of those variants have found is that they're often just less active as well as genome editors. So I think in the end, certainly those variants have a role to play for sure. But I think also it's been the case that as people have gotten a really good handle on just how much editing is, editor is needed to get a desired amount of editing, controlling the lifetime of the editor in the cell so it doesn't hang around for weeks and weeks, but, goes in, does its job, and then gets the heck out of there. Yeah, that's been important. And then I think also working with primary cells has shown that in many cases, they behave differently than cancer cells cultured in a lab dish. So all of those things, I think, have converged to show that at least in a number of cases, the fidelity of the existing enzymes, whether they're the natural ones or some of these variants, coupled with the using the right protocol and, primary cells, you can really get very high levels of accuracy of editing. And that's been shown by a number of labs, especially when you do, whole genome sequencing, looking for off targets, not just at places where you might predict an off target, but anywhere in the genome. And then, as David knows, there's also been, just a lot of attention paid to the actual technology of detecting off targets that's been incredibly valuable. So now I think it's pretty standard in the field to use one or more of the sequencing-based methods, whether it's GuideSeq or CircleSeq, technologies of that type, to look for off-target editing. And that's also added, a level of robustness to the field that it has been important for allowing different experimenters to compare their data across systems to look at the accuracy of editing.
Yeah, and I think Jennifer summarized it beautifully. I'll just add that because there are really no discontinuous functions in nature, there's never going to be perfectly specific binding of two molecules. And that's true of every molecule, large or small, that we put into patients. It will be true of genome editing agents. And therefore, in addition to this deep exploration and Zen-like understanding of specificity that the field is moving to achieve with the editing agents, I think we just have to be very thoughtful about matching agents with diseases and other applications of genome editing where the anticipated level of off-target editing is acceptable for the given application. Obviously, for diseases that are much more grievous than others, the level of risk that you might be willing to tolerate is higher. For certain other applications, which can also be very impactful in the world, like agricultural ones, you may care less about off-target editing. So the scope of genome editing is so broad because it is really the scope of DNA that I'm optimistic there will be a wide swath of applications that are well matched once we achieve an understanding not only of the editing side, but also of the acceptable risk tolerance on the application side.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One thing that the thing in recent years we've seen that we have actually moved substantially beyond just creating double-stranded breaks with first base editing and then prime editing now from your lab, David. When do you think we will see the first clinical applications or more general practical applications, maybe outside the clinic as well, of those tools?
Yeah, well, I think it's been publicly announced by Beam Therapeutics, which is trying to bring base editing to human patients, that they hope to be in the clinic by next year. So hopefully within our, you know, as I like to tell my students, within your PhD lifetime, you will see some of these non-cutting genome editing technologies actually reach patients.
I think another thing that going beyond even DNA now is the development of RNA editing technologies, either based on Cas enzymes or using endogenous ADAR enzymes. Where do you see the utility of those approaches, either practical or in basic research?
Well, you know, I'm an RNAophile from way back, right? So intrinsically, I love the idea of RNA editing. It's great. I think that, you know, the practical reality is that RNA editing for clinical purposes turns out to be challenging because obviously you would have to do it continuously. And that gets into issues of toxicity of the editor and, you know, efficiency. And I think that's, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why RNAi, as fantastic a technology as it is, has turned out to be challenging for certain kinds of applications where you need to have a long-term effect. I think that where RNA editing is really powerful is when you can make a transient change to the transcriptome that might have a desired effect, whether it's, I think about it less for, I guess, for clinical applications as for research purposes, particular, you know, being able to understand the role of particular transcripts, particular edited versions of mm-hmm. transcripts, I think is a really, really exciting application of RNA editing. So the more that that comes online as a way to manipulate individual types of RNA, especially if you can do things like control splice variants, I think that's going to be really powerful, primarily in the realm of research, I would say. I don't know if David disagrees with me on that.
No, maybe I'll just add that along the lines of applications where transient change in an RNA sequence could result in a permanent change to a cell or an organism, there are a number of differentiation, transdifferentiation, dedifferentiation pathways that are now beginning to be understood, some of which are biomedically relevant, therapeutically relevant, that potentially could be perturbed using RNA editing. But the challenges, of course, of of trying to go after targets where you anticipate needing to continuously dose a complicated macromolecule that probably is going to be immunogenic is certainly one consideration, as Jennifer mentioned.
Yeah, I think many of the same concerns apply to epigenome editing and gene activation use of Cas9 or other tools. Still, even for basic research, I'm always a bit surprised that those tools are not often used. I'm just wondering whether there are basic limitations, or that's maybe just a question of time, because the questions maybe that can be addressed by those kind of tools are a bit more involved.
I think the epigenetic tools are used quite a bit in research. CRISPR-A, CRISPR-I screens, for example, where eliminating the relationships between turning genes on and off and phenotypes of interest has really been advanced using those technologies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I also continue to hold out some hope for some of the reasons I just spoke about, that they could also be used, perhaps even in a clinical setting. But it's early for that.
Yeah, and I agree. I would just add that I think those, I think one of the reasons you haven't seen those used as widely, Marcus, is because, as you may know, those Cas proteins are highly engineered, and they're quite large, and they're just, again, not trivial to, you know, just technically to work with. And I haven't played with them that much in our own lab, but I know this from lots and lots of conversations about this with people like Jonathan Weissman and you know, his whole crew at UCSF doing this, that this is one of the big challenges. And as beautiful as that work has been, I think a continual issue is, you know, just how do you manipulate those proteins? Are you going to express them off of a virus? Are you going to express them off of an mRNA? Are you going to, you know, take the purified protein and introduce it into cells? And any of those methods has issues when you're dealing with a big, floppy, multi-domain, engineered protein. So I suspect that, you know, as the technology matures, and as you know, it's a, you know, very, very fast moving field, that, as David says, you know, we'll increasingly see that kind of application of CRISPR. And I'm very excited about the potential for it to have impacts in the clinic as well, because I think, like David said, you could imagine opportunities to make targeted and transient change to the epigenome that does end up having a long-term effect on a cell or tissue. So that's, I think, something that is in the future for genome editing.
And in fact, many of the natural biological changes in cell state or cell fate are thought to occur from transient changes to the epigenome. So
yeah,
cautiously optimistic that that will continue to be more and more useful as researchers expand their application of these tools. Mm-hmm.
We've mentioned delivery quite a few times now, and I think this seems to be the elephant in the room, not only for genome editing, but for many potentially powerful approaches. For genome editing, do you see any new approaches that are coming up, any grand new ideas that will make delivery easier? If you have any, you can.
David's looking at me and I'm looking at him.
Wait, can we show slides in this podcast? It's a grand, you know, it has been delivery of macromolecules in therapeutically relevant ways has been a grand challenge of the life sciences for decades, predating CRISPR, predating genome editing, really. You know, ever since we scientists discovered that missing proteins were the cause of metabolic disease, which is 100 plus years ago, doctors have aspired to figure out how to get missing enzymes, missing proteins into people. And while we can do that more easily if they're extracellular, if they're intracellular, it's still a humbling problem that we can know exactly what macromolecule is missing in a patient, in a patient's cells, and not be able to get that macromolecule in there in some cases. Now, there has been some progress, but the fact that the progress and the clinically approved forms of delivering genes, for example, in vivo, are limited thus far. If you count in vivo FDA-approved gene delivery vehicles, it's AAV, and I think that's it. It's a humbling realization that highlights just how challenging this problem is, and and also just how important the problem is. One of the legacies I hope genome editing will leave behind is that it will inspire generations of young, talented, creative scientists to go after delivery problems, because now more than ever before, we have even more important, even more urgent delivery problems we'd like to solve with the advent of these editing agents that bring so much promise in a test tube and in the laboratory. And fully realizing that promise in humans would, of course, be transformative.
So one question I ask myself a lot, and I'd love to know, you know, David, if you have thoughts about this. Am I allowed to ask a question, Marcus?
Yes.
In response to your question. But, you know, the question I ask myself a lot is, would we make more progress on delivery if we had a way to focus on it? Like if you had and I know there are a few labs that kind of focus on delivery, but what if you had a whole institute that was focused on delivery, or a company that was focused on delivery? And maybe since we're talking about CRISPR, you know, focused in particular on how to deliver genome editing molecules, would that be an effective strategy to accelerate the pace of discovery, or would it frankly not, because a lot of the discovery about delivery technologies comes about sort of driven by individual applications where you need to get into a certain cell type, and so you're going to target your technology development to that. I don't know. What do you think, David?
No, I was hoping you were saying that you were going to start such an institute.
You want to join me?
I was going to follow up with a few emails. I think that's I think it highlights that some out of the box approaches would be very useful now. And to some extent, I think we're trapped in a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, that a prophecy of limitation, where if we are choosing diseases largely on the basis of their ability to be addressed using known delivery modalities, like ex vivo electroporation of RNA into hematopoietic stem cells followed by transplant, or AAV to target organs that are known to have good transduction efficiencies with AAVs of known tropisms, then it creates less of a sense of urgency that discovering truly different and potentially transformative new kinds of delivery modalities is really what you want to do. And, you know, there is a temptation, and we certainly feel it in our lab, that because the editing agents are getting so capable, and because there's so much to do with treating genetic disease, why don't you just go after the low-hanging fruit where you already have a sense of how delivery is going to be done? But I think to make long-term progress at broadening the scope of what genome editing can really do will require getting out of the usual four or five delivery modalities and trying something truly different. And that's where I think an institute like Jennifer just proposed could be really useful.
I'll come to the opening symposium.
Marcus, you're going to fund it, I thought.
Oh, of course. Okay, the other, I think for genome editing, the other elephant in the room is immunogenicity. So do you think that will prove a real problem in the clinic? And if so, do you think we can engineer our way around immunogenicity problems?
Well, I mean, I guess the short answer is no, because if we did, we probably would be doing something else, I guess. But no, I think it is a really important point. It's, you know, if you're going to introduce a foreign protein into cells, not surprisingly, you know, it's going to trigger an immune response. And so how do we deal with that? Not to mention that there's also evidence that for at least some of these bacterial CRISPR-Cas proteins, there could be pre-existing immunity because of exposure to those pathogenic bacteria that, you know, many people have had. So, you know, I think that there's a couple of things that are interesting here. One is that, you know, genome editing is a therapy, is, as a treatment, is different than a lot of other therapies like, let's say, using antibodies, because in principle, you'd only have to deliver it once or maybe just a very few number, low number of times. So if you had really high efficiency of editing, you could imagine, you know, it's a one and done kind of treatment. And so even if there it does trigger an immune response, you're out of there and it doesn't matter. But I guess the other thing to think about is that, nature's come up with lots of different CRISPR-Cas proteins. Many of them come from non-pathogenic bacteria. And also they're really diverse, right? Because that's, this is a natural immune system that has to evolve very quickly to avoid being neutralized by bacteriophage. And so there's a lot of diversity that exists in nature. And then of course, very clever people, some of whom are on this podcast, are, able to come up with ways to create new variants that nature hasn't found, but also might be capable of avoiding triggering a robust immune response. So I think all of those things make me think that although this is absolutely something to pay attention to, it's probably not going to be a insurmountable problem.
Yeah, totally agree. Well said. I mean, this is why changing the genome is especially exciting compared to going after RNA or protein, because of the prospect that a one-time change can effect a permanent benefit to the patient. And of course, transient immunosuppression is commonly used in many treatments already, so it won't be the first time that one might imagine suppressing the immune system for a period of time. And, at least based on some of the early in vivo studies that have come out already, that period of transient immunosuppression, if necessary, may not even be that long. It may be on the order of days. So I agree with Jennifer that it doesn't appear to be a showstopper with respect to translating genome editing into the clinic.
I have one final question, and then you're off the hook. When we think about genetic diseases, for quite a lot of those diseases, there are many mutations that are found in different patients that can cause similar or identical diseases. In principle, it should be, especially with CRISPR, be easy to design individualized therapies. Do you think we will see that, especially with the current regulations that we have? Or are there also scientific problems to generating individualized therapies?
I think if the initial wave of genome editing therapeutics prove to be safe and efficacious, it will open the door to streamlining some of the safety and regulatory processes that have to be met. And some of those, people imagine, might include small changes in a guide RNA to accommodate somebody's specific mutation, for example. Now, that doesn't mean that such a different variant, if it's a guide RNA-based therapeutic, wouldn't have to go through a new set of some regulatory safety experiments, but perhaps they could be streamlined. And I've come to appreciate that FDA is actually really working hard to try to strike an optimal balance between getting these therapies to patients and ensuring that they have a safety margin that doesn't put the patients at unnecessary risk, recognizing that all new therapeutics come with some risk. So I think FDA is actually, in many ways, showing a lot of leadership to work with researchers and with companies to come up with creative ways to do exactly what you just proposed, how to quickly spread the benefit of a successful genome editing platform to as many patients as possible without unnecessarily elevating their risk.
Yeah, I would just add to that two things. One is that clearly the power of a programmable genome editing technology is exactly what you said, Marcus, right? It's, the potential to tailor it to a person's genome so that you can correct a disease-causing mutation in the context of, individual sequence variations. So I think that's very exciting and something that, is really offers the whole field the potential to be to bring the whole idea of personalized medicine into reality. But what goes along with that too, in addition to what David said, which I fully agree with on the regulatory side, is thinking about affordability. How do we make sure that, you know, if you're going to have a tailored therapy, that sounds great, but if it costs $2 million a person, it's not very useful. And so I think that, you know, increasingly what I spend time thinking about is how do we continue to advance the technology, always thinking about, you know, how do we do it in a way that will lower cost and make it more accessible to people, not less. And it's a tall order, but I think it's something really, really important to be thinking about given the pace of the field and where things are today.
So David, Jennifer, can't thank you enough for offering your time for this podcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you both. It was a pleasure.
Pleasure to talk to you both.
Okay, that's the end of the roundtable. Thank you to the guests. Thank you, Marcus, for hosting. That's the end of episode 7. Again, this is associated with our July focus issue on CRISPR tools and therapies. That issue is out now. If you'd like to subscribe to this podcast or First Rounders, just search Nature Biotechnology and Forum or Nature Biotechnology and First Rounders in whatever app you use and you'll find them. If you'd like to discuss this podcast, you can find us on Twitter. Our handle is @NatureBiotech. Thank you to the Midwest Quiet for use of their music in this podcast. That's it. Until the next one, goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.